So I want to welcome you to week three of our series called Signs. For those of you hopping in for the first time, what we're doing is we're looking at a number of miracles that Jesus performed in John's gospel. But according to John, he didn't just call these miracles, he called them signs. At the end of his gospel, he said that these signs that we're looking at each week were recorded not to just amaze us, not to fascinate us, not to make us say wow or even inspire us, but to lead us beyond the signs themselves to Jesus. And John said that these were actually recorded so that in studying them and understanding really what they reveal about Jesus, that we would believe that Jesus is who he said he is, and that by believing in Jesus, we would find the life that can only be found through a relationship with him. And so each week, every week, we're just looking at what Jesus did and asking ourselves what that says about him. So we're going to look at the third sign of Jesus this week. It's found in John chapter 5. I'm going to read verses 1 through 9. They say this. After this, a Jewish festival took place, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. By the sheep gate in Jerusalem, there's a pool called Bethesda in Hebrew, which has five colonnades. Within these lay a large number of the sick, blind, lame, and paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water because an angel would go down into the pool from time to time to stir up the water. Then the first one who got in after the water was stirred up recovered from whatever ailment he had. A lot of your Bibles do not include that text. I'm going to explain that in a few minutes. Verse 5, one man was there who'd been sick for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to get well?" Interesting question. Verse 7, "Sir," the sick man answered, "I don't have a man to put me in the pool when the water's stirred up, but while I'm coming, someone goes down ahead of me." "Get up," Jesus told him, "pick up your mat and walk." Instantly, the man got well, picked up his mat, and started to walk. We're going to park it right there and start moving through this. So on the front end of this story, it's important to remember, we kind of touched on this last week, that at this time in Jesus' ministry, he's really becoming somewhat of a celebrity. He's turned water into wine. He's overturned tables in the temple. He's performed a number of miracles that John doesn't get into specifics about. We saw him heal the official son last week. And so here Jesus, with a little bit of gravitational pull to him, is at the front end of this story. He's going to Jerusalem, and John says he's going there while a festival that he doesn't name, some festival is taking place. What that meant is that there was going to be people, Jerusalem was going to be teeming with people from all over the ancient world. And so this was an opportunity for Jesus really to begin networking. This was an opportunity for Jesus to kind of start building relationships and rubbing shoulders with some people in high places, which is no doubt exactly what his disciples expected him to do. But in this story, Jesus did what he so often did, which is the exact opposite of what people thought he would do. In verse 2, we read, "By the sheep gate in Jerusalem, there is a pool called Bethesda in Hebrew, which has five colonnades. Within these lay a large number of the sick, blind, lame, and paralyzed." So of all the places that Jesus could go during this festival, he decides to go directly to what was the most miserable place in all of Jerusalem. This was a place where the sickest of the sickest people would all gather together, the people with the most serious ailments, debilitating diseases, which raises the question, well, why were they there? And in the next verse, rather the next part of this verse, it explains why they were there. It says, "waiting for the moving of the water because an angel would go down into the pool from time to time and stir up the water. Then the first one who got in after the water was stirred up recovered from whatever ailment he had." Now, a lot of your Bibles don't even include this, but if you have the same version that I do, which is the Holman Christian, it includes that in brackets. The reason for that is because the Bible that we have is made up of thousands of manuscripts, which is why it's so reliable. And what we found in comparing those manuscripts is that the earliest ones do not include this note about God sending an angel and stirring the water and giving it healing properties. So the Bible doesn't actually teach that this body of water legitimately healed people. But what this story reveals is that people really did believe that it did. That's really important to note in just a few minutes here. But anyway, in verse 5, we read, "One man was there who had been sick for 38 years. Now, other versions of the Bible describe this man as an invalid. The Greek word that John uses to describe him that gets translated sick in my version very simply means that this man had no strength. So just consider this. Of all the places that Jesus could have gone during this festival, he decides to go to the Pool of Bethesda. Of all the people Jesus could have gone to in the crowd that day at the Pool of Bethesda, he goes to this man who John says had no strength. Now, this series is at its core, it's all about just looking at what Jesus did and asking ourselves what that says about Jesus. And the fact that Jesus went to this man, what that shows us about him is going to be our first idea this morning. It's that, number one, Jesus goes to people who have no strength. Right, at this time in Jesus' ministry, any campaign advisor worth their salt would have told Jesus, now's the time to begin pivoting toward the upper class, toward people who are influential, affluent, and powerful, and you're going to want to make friends with those people if you want to affect any real change in the world. Instead, what you're seeing here is Jesus intentionally went to a place where the influential, the affluent, and the powerful would not have been caught dead. All right, the Pool of Bethesda was such a rough place that it was believed that passing through there would make you ceremonially unclean. And if you just use your imagination for a minute, it's not hard to see why they thought that. All right, there was not government health care in Jesus' day. These people were not well taken care of. There were a number of them would have been too great a burden for their family to bear. Everybody else has their life to live, so people would just get dumped in a place like this. John said that these people were blind. He said that they were lame. He said that they were paralyzed, meaning they can't take care of themselves, so they're just left to basically rot out in the sun all day. With that in mind, think about what this place looked like. Think about what it smelled like. And this is where Jesus decided to go. And of all the people there that day, John says that Jesus came to a man who, really, even if he wanted to, simply didn't have the strength to go to Jesus himself. Now, if you've been at this church for any length of time, you know that I bring this up often. I actually talked about it a little bit 7 days ago, but the reason I bring this idea up so often is because I think we're too quick to forget it, and we really need to remember it. It's ideas like this one right here that show us exactly how profound a distance there is between Christianity and not other religions, but the general teaching of religion itself. All right, religion as a system is it's a way of life, and it's a way of relating to God that has a lot in common with something like trying to get into a prestigious school or trying to land a job. All right, I remember when I was trying to get into the fire department and going through the hiring process, the first step of that process was taking the written test. And on that day, they had 1,600 people come out to the Anne Arundel County Community College to take the test. Far and away, the most demoralizing step of the process for me. The lines literally seemed like they just went on for miles. After taking that test, if you passed it, you got to take a physical test. If you passed that, you got to sit in an interview. If you passed that, you had to go to a doctor. They'd give you a physical exam and see if you were healthy enough to do the job. If you passed that, you got a background investigation. And if you got through all of those things, you were invited to the fire academy, where every day you were on trial. If you ever got below a 60, you're fired. If you get below a 70, they give you one chance to retake it. If you can't hack it, you're gone. They just escort you to your car. After 6 months of that, you're invited to go to the field, not as a full-fledged employee, but as a, this is like the worst term in the world, probationary firefighter, which means you are qualified to scrub toilets. And over a period of 6 months, you get very good at scrubbing toilets. And at the end of that six-month period, if your supervisors say so, then and they believe that you're a good fit and you know, you've acclimated to the job and all that stuff, then you're finally in. You can take a deep breath. You're in the union. You're kind of like a made man, unless you're dumb enough to quit that job and become a pastor. Side note. but the reason I bring all this up is because religion as a way of relating to God is so much like that. Religion as a way of life is just, it's a life of endless tests where you always have to prove yourself and you always have to justify yourself and you always have to earn your keep and there's always a test for you to pass or fail and it's all about your strength and it's all about your ability and there is no more exhausting way to live. What happens to people when they try to relate to God or when they live or believe like they're standing with God depends on their strength or their ability for long enough, it leads to high highs and really low lows. Very religious people will go through periods of life where they have really high highs and actually they'll become quite arrogant and prideful. I'm speaking from personal experience, by the way, and judgmental when they look down on other people that they think they're doing better than. But what that always leads to is failure, because none of us are perfect. And if you're living according to your own strength and your own ability, then eventually you're headed for a season of life where you're filled with condemnation that you can't get up from. You're filled with despair. It's like a total loss of your identity, and it's all because your life is built on your strength and your ability. Understand this. Christianity is not a different shade of that idea. It's a departure from that way of life entirely. See, John says that Jesus specifically went to a man who had no strength, but that didn't scare Jesus away, because Christianity is not about your strength. It's about Jesus' strength. All right, the man in this story had nothing to offer Jesus, either financially or relationally or politically or otherwise. But that didn't scare Jesus away, because Christianity is not about what you're able to offer Jesus. It's about what he's willing to offer you. So Jesus comes to this man who didn't have any strength in and of himself, and they have this really interesting exchange. Verse 6 says, when Jesus saw him lying there, and knew he'd already been there a long time, he said to him, do you want to get well? This is an incredibly interesting question to me. This guy has been disabled for going on 4 decades. That's almost the average lifespan of a male in this day. He spent the entire time lying on this mat that was really effectively his prison. And Jesus' first question is, do you want to get well? I've heard a lot of people preach this text or explain this text, and one of the ideas that I've heard pulled from this text is that Jesus asked this question to demonstrate the fact that you really need to desire healing before you get it, and if you really believe it, then and only then can you really receive it. This story is in no way, shape, or form written to teach us that idea, and the reason that I say that with some confidence is because the man never says yes. He never exhibits even a shred of faith in this story. So the question is, why would Jesus ask a question like that? A friend of mine just recently told me, and I didn't check this, but it sounds good, that 155 times, so full disclaimer, he said 155 times Jesus asked questions throughout his ministry. I don't know the exact number, but I know he asked questions a lot. What I do know is that Jesus never asked the question because he was unaware of the answer. The only reason he ever asked an individual a question was for their benefit. See, Jesus, in a lot of ways, the way that I understand him, he's like a brilliant counselor. And what a good counselor will do when you come into their office and you lay your cards on the table and all your baggage and your relational woes and all that kind of stuff, a good counselor, instead of giving you answers, is going to ask you questions. And those questions are designed to reveal things in you that you wouldn't otherwise be able to see or deal with yourself. And so what Jesus' question does for this man is it reveals something in him that actually you and I can learn a great deal from. Listen to his answer. Verse 7, sir, the sick man answered, I don't have a man to put me into the pool when the water's stirred up, but while I'm coming, someone goes down ahead of me. What catches my attention about that is that Jesus asked a very straightforward question. Do you want to get well? That invites one of two responses, yes, or conversely, no. But that's not an answer to this question. So here we have a really straightforward question, and the man just kind of comes at it sideways. But what his answer reveals, and this is so important, what his answer reveals is where his hope was. Everything about that answer reveals that he believed the only ticket out of the life he was living was this water. Because think about what he's saying there. I don't have any friends to get me in the water. Other people get into it, you know, before me, and somebody hops in, and I just don't have the strength. I'm just not fast enough to get to that water. In his mind, he believed, oh, if Jesus is going to help me, he's got to get me to that water somehow. Now, I mentioned this earlier. The Bible doesn't actually teach that this water legitimately healed anybody. What's far more likely is that there was an underground spring that would surge every once in a while, and it disturbed that water, and you know, somebody would hop in. I don't think that anybody was ever legitimately healed here. But either way, it's a really sad picture that you see at the Pool of Bethesda, because we see that this guy, almost for the average lifespan of a man in his day, had suffered from a disability that left him with no strength. Jesus said that he'd been here for a long time. That could be hours, that could be days, that could be months. Most likely it was years that this man was chasing this superstitious belief in miraculous healing water that had never done anything for him, but here he is still trying. So he thought, well, if Jesus is going to get me well, Jesus is going to get me in the water. But Jesus was not interested in putting that man in the water because he could see something that even after 38 years, this man still couldn't see, which is that the water that he was putting his hope in would never really help him. So here's what Jesus said. Verse 8. And I just wonder, like, I wonder how this was said. Get up. Well, like, how did Jesus really say that? Like, get up. Enough of this. Just stop. Just get up. Forget about the water. Say that the pool's dirty anyway. Just get up. Jesus told him, pick up your mat and walk. Verse 9, instantly the man got well, picked up the mat, and started to walk. What this says about Jesus is our second idea this morning. It's number two. It's that Jesus came to provide a new way of life. All right, like I mentioned, everything about this man's answer indicated that he thought that that pool was necessary in giving him the life that he wanted, in escaping the life that he certainly did not want to live anymore. But here's what Jesus doesn't do here. He doesn't offer him a more comfortable mat to sit on while he waited for the water to stir. He doesn't command some of his disciples to keep him company so that they can pick him up and throw him into the water the next time it stirs. He doesn't offer to supernaturally make the water stir himself because Jesus wasn't there to be a part of his old life. He was there to call him into new life. And that's what Jesus does. When Jesus enters into our lives, it's not to perform the work of modification. It's to perform the work of transformation. He offers a completely brand new way of life. So that's the miracle. That's the story, and it's incredible, and that's where you think it would end. And if it did, then I could call Sarah up right now. We'd have a nice, quick sermon. Nobody's ever mad about that. We could go about our way. But just when you think this sermon's over, sorry, we read in the second half of verse 9, a very interesting detail. Now that day was the Sabbath. I can tell you this, that detail is not in there for no reason. A lot happens after this, but I'll just summarize this. What happens is because Jesus healed this man and told him to pick up his mat and walk on the Sabbath, the man winds up getting interrogated by the Jewish religious authorities who want to know why he's carrying his mat around because there were all these rules on the Sabbath, which they made up, they weren't really in the Bible. So the man, kind of like buckling under pressure, says, the man who healed me told me to carry it, which is basically, take it up with him, this isn't on me kind of thing. So they ask him who the man was that healed him, and I think this is amazing, he didn't know. And if you read the story, the guy's not lying. It's not that the guy says, I don't know. John says he didn't know. So just wrap your head around that. He was disabled for about 4 decades and didn't take the time to know the name of the guy that healed him. Maybe I'm overestimating myself. I think I would have figured that out. Just a thought. So anyway, the guy doesn't know who healed him. And then you'd think the story's over again, but sure enough, Jesus comes and finds him later on, tells him not to sin anymore. Great advice. And the man, in having an interaction with Jesus, then makes a beeline to the religious authorities and basically dimes Jesus out. He basically tells on Jesus. And simply because of this, we read in verses 16 through 18 that the religious leaders begin persecuting Jesus with the intent to kill him. So this is a marked change in the tide, in the atmosphere, in the climate, in Jesus' ministry, where people go from, you know, on the one hand, they were kind of skeptical, if not suspicious about him. Now they're downright hostile toward him, and it's all for one reason. It's all because he decided to heal this man on the Sabbath. Had Jesus done this on any other day, he could have been hailed as a hero. Now he's being hunted as a criminal, and Jesus knew that this is how things were going to break. So it all forces me to ask the question, why do this on the Sabbath? Knowing all the smoke, all the heat, all the tension, why do this on the Sabbath? Here's why. Jesus healed this man the way that he did to show that he came to provide a brand new way of life. But he healed this man on the Sabbath to show us what kind of life he came to provide. And this brings us to our third, and it'll be our last idea this morning. It's that Jesus came to provide a life of rest. And I don't know that there is a culture in history more in need of that than this one. Anybody here feel exhausted? Anybody here looking for rest? That's what Jesus came to provide. Now, to understand the significance of this story, really, you got to go back to the very first Sabbath and understand what the Sabbath was originally supposed to be about. And you find that all the way back in the Old Testament, thousands of years before this, in the book of Exodus. In Exodus 16, you read that God had just delivered his people from slavery in Egypt, brought them out into the wilderness, which was great. But being out in the wilderness, they were completely dependent on God to provide for them. And so that's what God did. And the Bible says he caused this bread to rain down from heaven called manna. And with that bread, Moses gave the people very specific instructions. He said, every morning you're to go out and gather as much as you want to eat that day, but don't stockpile the manna. Don't save any for the next day. People didn't believe Moses. And what they found is that every time they tried to save it overnight, it would spoil, be completely unusable. Probably unusual too. It was manna. It was bread from heaven. It's not like any other bread. On the sixth day, the rules changed. And Moses said, on the sixth day, what you're supposed to do is go out in the morning, gather twice as much manna as usual, and you'll find two things to be true on the seventh day. First off, you'll find that all the manna that you saved will not spoil. It'll keep so that you have something for the seventh day. But what you'll also find is that God's not going to cause any manna to fall on the seventh day because that was the day of rest. Now, when God, that was the very first Sabbath, that was the idea. The reason that God instituted that was not just so that people wouldn't do something on one day of the week. The Sabbath was about so much more than just not doing something one day of the week. The Sabbath was about resting in the knowledge that God really did care about you and trusting him to provide for you in ways you'd never be able to provide for yourself. That's so important, I have to repeat that. The Sabbath, as instituted by God, was originally given to teach people to rest in the knowledge that God was the one that cared for them and teach them to trust that God would provide for them in ways they'd never be able to provide for themselves. Now, thousands of years after that, by the time of Jesus, the concept of Sabbath had been so hijacked, it was completely removed from what God's original intention was. They added all these rules and regulations. They actually came up with a list of 39 kinds of work they decided you weren't supposed to do on the Sabbath. None of it was in the Bible. And they so hyper-focused on these rules, as you can see in this story, that here a guy who had been saved from a life of lying on a mat after 38 years, and they don't even notice that part. They just want to know why he's carrying his mat in his hand. Just so hyper-focused on these rules and these regulations. And the religious leaders not only did that with the Sabbath, they did that with the entire law. They added all these rules and all these regulations, and in doing so, they forgot that the whole purpose of the law was to teach us that we need a Savior. So here they were, working hard, killing themselves, trying to earn their keep, to earn their spot in God's family, forgetting that the whole spirit of the law was to teach us that no matter how hard we work, we'll never be able to do that. Now, when you understand this, I know I took my time getting here, but when you understand this, you realize there's a really subtle but really powerful irony in this story. And the moment that I saw it is really the moment this whole story opened up. And if you miss this, you really miss everything. So follow me here. The irony of this story is that the people that were so angry at Jesus for healing this man at the pool of Bethesda were looking to the law exactly the way the man was looking to the pool. See, in this story, the man believed that if he just tried harder, that pool would heal him, that pool would save him. And the religious leaders in Jesus' day were doing the exact same thing with the law. They believed that they just tried harder, that law could save them, that law could give them the life that they've always wanted. And Jesus did what he did in this story to teach them both something that they would never be able to see on their own. Jesus healed this man the way that he did to show him that he came to provide a way of life that the pool of Bethesda was never going to be able to provide. But he did it on the Sabbath to show people that he was here to provide the rest that the Sabbath day was never going to be able to provide us with. See, what the religious leaders had forgotten, even though the Old Testament whispers the name of Jesus and points forward to who Jesus was, they just couldn't see it even though they were walking with him. But what everything in the Old Testament was always meant to point forward to, the Sabbath, the Old Testament law, the covenant that God made with people, it was always pointing to something greater because true rest could never be found in a day. It could only be found in a person, and that person was the Son of God himself. And for every single person who comes to Jesus, what they'll receive is not another checklist to fill out, not a series of duties to perform, but the kind of rest that our souls are hardwired to need because Jesus came to provide a life of rest. Let me call the teams up and we're going to wind down. There's one final question I want to answer this morning, and it's how can Jesus do this? I mean, it's amazing news that Jesus can provide us with a life of rest, but why is it that Jesus is able to do this? The reason Jesus can provide you personally with a kind of rest that you'll never find outside of him is because Jesus did not come down here primarily to be your example. He came down here to be your substitute. Meaning Jesus did not come to this planet to show you the way and tell you what you needed to do. He came down to this planet to stand in your place and do what you could never do for yourself. And that's what the gospel is. The gospel is not good advice about what you and I need to do with our lives. It's good news about what Jesus has done for us. And I'll make this personally for me. The gospel says that Jesus has lived the perfect life so I don't have to. The gospel has said that Jesus paid for every single one of my sins so I don't have to. And so the gospel says the moment that I gave my life to Jesus, the moment that you gave your life to Jesus, and for those listening to this that haven't done that, the moment you will give your life to Jesus, that very moment, God stops interacting with you on the basis of what you have done or have not done, and he begins interacting with you on the basis of what Jesus has done in your place. So the only thing left to do for us is what God's people were called to do on that very first Sabbath, which is rest in the knowledge that God cares for us, and he has provided for us in a way that we could never provide for ourselves, and he does that through his son Jesus. When Jesus called out on the cross just a few years after this sign that he performed, when Jesus called out on the cross with the words, "It is finished," he was not saying that he'd done his part and now it was up to you to do yours. What he was saying is that everything necessary for you to come home to God and find salvation rather than rejection was done, period. And the only thing left for a bunch of sinners like you and me to do was trust that Jesus is enough. So I want to close with this. When I zoom out from this story, what I see here at the Pool of Bethesda is somebody who was utterly exhausted. John says he had no strength. That's what it means to be exhausted, to just have no more gas in your tank. He was exhausted, and he was putting his hope in something that had always failed to deliver for him, but he kept going back, hoping, thinking, believing, maybe next time will be different, but it never was. And maybe when you see that picture, and when you hear it put in those terms, maybe you're listening to this, and if you got real honest, you know that you and that man have a lot more in common than you thought. Maybe you've been putting your hope in something to satisfy you, to bring you joy, to make you happy, to make your life worth living, and it's consistently failed to deliver for you. And maybe part of you knows that it will always consistently fail to deliver for you, but here you are going back to it, and you're just exhausted. If that's you, if that sounds anything like you, based on this story, I can tell you with conviction, Jesus came here for people just like you, right where you are. And John said this sign was recorded in this gospel account, not just so that you'd be inspired or so that you'd be fascinated or intellectually stimulated, but so that in hearing what Jesus has done, you would believe in who Jesus is, and in believing in him, that you'd find life in his name. So I just want to close with this. To anybody listening to this who's exhausted, anybody listening to this who's exhausted, I want to read you a promise from Jesus from Matthew 11, verse 28. Jesus said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." You don't have to work for it. You don't have to earn it. You don't have to make sure you haven't done any really bad sins or you have a period of time between you and your last sin. You just get to Jesus and he'll give it to you. He said, "All of you take up my yoke and learn from me because I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you'll find rest for yourselves." We're never going to find rest in this world. Never. We'll find more exhaustion, more disappointment, more dissatisfaction, but we'll find rest in the arms of Jesus. He said, "For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Of all the ways that I can end this teaching, I just want to end by saying this. We're going to end in one more song. And if you're here listening to this and you're tired of being tired, why don't you do something that you've never done and come find rest in a relationship with Jesus, because he's waiting to give it to you. That's it. That's all.